The order is out. Articles of impeachment are being drafted. Texas A&M constitutional scholar Lynn Rambo tells us what this means today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Joy Diaz. Today we explore how exactly immigrant detention centers provide a cost savings to the federal government. Why aren't more Democratic presidential campaigns safeguarding their emails? Our tech expert explains. Fort Worth ISD is working with newly arrived refugee children. How and what are they doing differently? Travel tips and linguistics and a whole lot more when the only show, the National News Show of Texas, begins. Things are moving swiftly. The Speaker of the House, the number three most powerful politician in the nation, Nancy Pelosi, asking that articles of impeachment be drafted. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown, and it's Thursday, December the 5th. Welcome to the Texas Standard. If it feels like it's hard to catch up with all the news, if you were thinking that today you'd be analyzing the testimony of the four constitutional scholars who presented arguments just yesterday, for and against impeachment before the House Judiciary Committee, well, you won't have time. The House is moving forward. But here at the Texas Standard, we decided to dial things back a bit. Let's take some time for analysis because the implications of this news could be huge. For Texas, for the nation, for the world. Lynn Rambo specializes in constitutional law at Texas A&M University School of Law in Fort Worth, and we invited her here with that purpose. Professor Rambo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this morning is asking House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler to move forward with drafting articles of impeachment. And from a legal standpoint, do you think the testimony we heard yesterday by constitutional scholars in the House Judiciary Committee, did it make the case for moving forward?
I think it did. If you look at the three witnesses in favor of moving forward, they set up exactly what an impeachable offense is, what happened, and how impeachment has been handled in the past. And so I think that they did make a case for moving forward with articles of impeachment.
When you were talking about the first three witnesses, it seems like it was a very partisan display yesterday. It was almost like, okay, first go the three Democrats, maybe, or at least Democratic-friendly scholars, and then a Republican-friendly scholar. Did it feel that way to you?
Yeah, I think that's a function of the way our houses of Congress are set up. You know, whenever you have a party in charge of a particular house, they get to constitute more of committees. They get to lead the agenda. So it is frequently set up that way. But I'm certain that it could appear that way to the public, for sure.
And you yourself are a constitutional scholar, so nothing that you heard yesterday was new to you. But I wonder if anything stood out.
I think Professor Carlin's hypothetical was a terrific way to talk to the American people about what happened in Ukraine.
When she was talking about the aid?
Yes. When she was talking about if you were someone, if there were a conversation with a governor.
And she used Texas specifically.
Well, she did. She certainly talked about, I think, Texas and Louisiana having been through the floods that they have been through recently in Hurricane Katrina. And the idea that if aid were being withheld in that situation in exchange for branding an opponent a criminal, we would all know that that was impeachable conduct. I think that the primary point of Professor Turley, he was representing, shall we say, the Republican position.
Absolutely.
And his point was, number one, that this is a very important proceeding, but I don't really think that contrasts with the way that the other witnesses felt, that it was going too quickly in comparison to, say, the Nixon impeachment inquiry. But number three, he also felt as though there was some confusion on the part of the Democratic witnesses as to whether or not this was the crime of bribery, or whether it was abuse of power. And he had objection to the way that he felt they were tossing around the term bribery.
This is a huge deal. It's not every day that a president is in the process of being impeached, whatever the outcome. And you have experienced this. So how do you think the world will perceive this latest news of Nancy Pelosi asking for the drafting of articles of impeachment?
Well, I hope that they will regard it as extremely important. On some level, I wonder if they don't regard it as almost more important than the American people do, which I find a little distressing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I just think that a level of cynicism has somehow enveloped the American people that is very, very unfortunate and needs to change. We need to do something to make sure that all of our citizens are voting. We need to make sure that all of our citizens are not feeling disillusioned by the process, by the electoral process, so that we can ensure that we have government, you know, positive government that extends well into the future on a democratic basis. And I have some concerns about that.
We've been speaking with Lynn Rambo. She specializes in constitutional law at Texas A&M University School of Law in Fort Worth. Professor Rambo, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day, Joy.
This week, the Department of Agriculture approved a new rule that could ultimately lead toward the removal of 3 million people from the food stamps rolls. The first phase got final approval on Wednesday, affecting an estimated 700,000 people. The Trump administration reasons that unemployment is so low that this type of limited assistance to some lower-income workers is not necessary. Texas Standard's host, David Brown, spoke to Lola Fadulu, a New York Times reporter in Washington, and he asked if the policy we're really talking about here is SNAP and what specific changes will be made.
So the rule that was finalized affects able-bodied adults without children. And so right now, this group of people can receive food stamps for 3 months out of a 36-month period without working. But some states can allow this group of people to receive food stamps for a longer amount of time without working. And the department's rule wants to make it more difficult for states to waive that time limit.
I see. So we're talking about, let me make sure that I've got this. We're talking about able-bodied adults. I presume that means 18 or older. And we are talking about who do not have children, but are currently receiving SNAP benefits.
Yes, correct. The idea is that adults who can work should work. And so the department has used able-bodied adults without children as sort of a proxy for finding that group of adults who can work. The idea is that, oh, they don't have children, so there's maybe no excuse for them not to work. But I've spoken to several anti-poverty experts, and they've said that this group of people, they may not be working for a variety of reasons. If they're eligible for food stamps, they are low income, and so they're likely low-wage workers, which means that they're probably working, but they are working in a market where it's difficult to consistently work 20 hours a week. And then they're also, it's possible this group of people, they're battling other difficulties that come along with poverty, such as homelessness or health issues or transportation issues.
I see. Is it clear at all how this is going to break down state by state? I mean, it sounds like this could have a rather large impact, unless, of course, the state has not been giving out too many waivers.
Yeah, so I haven't seen an analysis yet that breaks down what the impact will be on the states, but I do know that all of the states except for Delaware have used these waivers in the past 23 years. And in 2008, after the recession, just about all of the states were using these waivers. And governors typically turn to these waivers whenever there's been an economic downturn or mm-hmm. there's difficulty. They want to make sure that people can still afford to eat.
I understand there are a couple of other rule changes in the works. Tell us about those.
Yes. So the second proposed rule, so the one that was finalized on Wednesday was the first one. The second one would remove nearly 3 million people from the food stamps rules by tweaking who is automatically eligible for food stamps. So the way it works now is if there are people who qualify for assistance from temporary assistance for needy families, which is another low-income program, mm-hmm. they're automatically eligible. And so this proposed rule wants to tweak that rule, and that would result in nearly 3 million people losing food stamps, and then also nearly 1 million children losing automatic access to free school meals. And then the other rule would cut $4.5 billion from the food stamp program over the course of 5 years. And that would result in 1 in 20 families seeing a change in their benefits. They could lose as much as $75 per month. 1 in 5 families could see that change in their benefits.
Lola Fadulu is a reporter for the New York Times. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Lola, thanks for your explanation. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar. He monitors the talk of Texas on social media. Wells, welcome.
Hi, Joy. Good to see you there again.
Thank you.
Our friends and listeners are sounding off about the story we just heard, how the Trump administration is moving to take food stamps away from as many as 3 million Americans. Some mm-hmm. 700,000 have already been affected. On our Facebook page, Samuel David Holbrooks says, when you have near full participation in the workforce, these numbers should drop. It would be complete government waste to leave them at Obama-era levels. I'm happy for those who have become self-sufficient and no longer need the help. There's one perspective. Mm. However, Barbara Stansfield Terry, she writes that the nation can afford to give roughly $14 billion to big agriculture as a bailout for Trump's disastrous trade war, referring to those farm subsidies. So why are we going to remove poor folks from food assistance programs that cost far, far less per month? How does that make sense? Barbara goes on to say that the Trump administration is punishing the poor so the rich can have more. Well, we've got several more folks chiming in as yeah. well online, Joy. We're also seeing lots of reaction to yesterday's impeachment hearing testimony.
I'm sure.
Plus, yeah, plus that latest development, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's announcement the House will proceed with drafting articles of impeachment against President Trump.
One interesting thing that I've heard is, you know, able-bodied does not mean that your mind is able mm-hmm. to work. You know, a lot of people with mental illness who cannot work, reach out to us. We read your letters, your emails, texasstandard@kut.org.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. The Trump administration announced earlier this fall a new annual cap on the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. It's been cut from 30,000 to 18,000 people. And that's not only affecting resettlement agencies, it's also affecting schools. As KERA Stella Chavez reports, that's changing how the Fort Worth School District is teaching some of its newcomers.
Sharon Darnell spends most of the school day going from class to class.
Okay, we're going where the clock is, the door right below the clock.
Darnell is a specialized English as a second language teacher. She pushes a cart with word flashcards, books, and sound charts to her next stop.
Avoid, what does avoid mean?
To sit.
To stay.
To stay away from.
Good job.
This fourth grader from Rwanda is one of 30 English language learners Darnell works with at Seminary Hills Park Elementary. For the last few years, the school district's seen its number of refugee students decline. Add in the recent cap imposed by the Trump administration, and there are no longer enough new arrivals to continue the Language Center program in elementary schools. Prior to this school year, the district had language centers at 13 elementary campuses. Students whose native language isn't English or Spanish were placed there with the goal of transitioning them to a regular classroom in 2 years. Karen Neal oversees the district's ESL program.
We were predicting to have 50 immigrant students across the district at the elementary school level.
And 50 refugee students spread throughout several schools isn't enough to justify language centers. There are fewer older students, too.
We have lost a lot of our numbers at middle school. We still have larger numbers at high school, but depending upon what the federal government does with immigration, you know, at any moment that may change.
This school year, there's a specialized ESL teacher at 11 elementary schools with the highest number of English language learners. They come from all over the world.
Honduras and the South African countries. And previously, when the refugee camps were still open in Nepal and Myanmar, we had larger numbers of those students.
Sharon Darnell used to teach her own beginner's class for English learners. There was also a class for intermediate students. Now, she pulls kids out of their classrooms or works alongside their regular teacher.
So this year, I'm having my beginners and my intermediates in the same group in the same classroom. So I'm seeing students who need to learn their ABCs along with students who can read a little bit already.
On this morning, Darnell pops into a classroom where students are learning vocabulary words.
Hey, Jelaine, you learned about distraction. Do you remember what it means?
Yes, it's something that makes people or animals want to look away or think about something else.
Okay. Do we need to be focused sometimes?
Yeah.
Okay, so we...
Darnell says the best thing about her job, her students are eager to learn. Some didn't have enough schooling in the countries they came from, and some went through unimaginable trauma.
They've seen bombs go up. They've seen people get blown away. They've seen guns come out and kill their family members. They've been without food, without clothing.
And that's why she understands if her students struggle to learn new words or forget to do their homework. It's also why she'll keep teaching, no matter how many times her job description changes. I'm Stella Chavez for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Remember when thousands of emails were stolen from the Democratic National Committee in 2016? Well, security experts quickly knew the reason because a campaign operative had clicked on a link on an email that looked like a Google security warning, but it wasn't. And that opened the door to hackers who quickly took over that account. The experience, though, hasn't translated into more vigilance from 2020 presidential campaigns. Listen to this. According to the news site TechCrunch, most campaigns aren't using a simple technology that could keep their emails from being hacked. We brought in tech expert Omar Gallaga to fill us in. How are you, Omar?
Hey, Joy. Good to see you.
Let's go to the beginning. Let's talk about email spoofing. How does it work?
Well, there's spoofing, there's phishing, there's all kinds of different ways that people
phishing with PH.
With a PH, yeah. That people can get at your emails. Spoofing is typically when someone pretends to be from a certain domain. So if you got an email from, say, the Joe Biden campaign, but it wasn't really from their campaign,
I see.
That's someone spoofing the domain. Phishing is like the one you described that John Podesta, who was the Hillary Clinton campaign manager, fell into, which was someone sending you a malicious email with a fake link. Then they want you to click on it, which a lot of us have fallen for.
Right.
That is a very common one. So, there's been a lot of concern this year among security experts that a lot of these presidential campaigns are just not locking down their email and securing it the way they should.
And what's at risk? I mean, let's say they don't secure it. What's at risk?
Like what happened in 2016 is that these email addresses could be exposed, they could send out fake emails, and they could also be subject to foreign influence or cyber attacks. So, you know, a lot of the things we saw in 2016 could happen again, and it seems like a lot of campaigns just haven't learned that lesson.
So it's not as simple as, oh, well, we don't mind if anybody else reads our emails. It's the fact of it. There can be dire consequences.
The entire domains could be taken over, yeah.
Absolutely. So what's one simple way that campaigns can use to protect their group's email?
Well, there is an email security protocol called DMARC, and I'm going to get a little geeky here. It's Domain-Based Message Authentication Reports and Conformance. And this standard has been around since, I think, 2012, 2013, and it's a very simple, free way to prevent those attacks. It authenticates not only incoming emails, but it also prevents spoofing. So only about 5 campaigns are actually using this protocol, DMARC.
Really?
That is the Biden campaign, the the Klobuchar campaign, Booker, Gabbard, and Bullock and Harris, who both dropped out.
Okay. Now...
Oh, and Bloomberg. Bloomberg also.
Oh, Bloomberg is using it. So what that tells me is that are these only Democratic presidential campaigns who are using it? Who's not using it?
Donald Trump's campaign is not using it, which is surprising.
The president's campaign is not using it.
Given all we've been through, yeah. So, out of what, 18 or 19 campaigns that are still going, yeah, only about 5 are using this protocol.
And so it's spelled an uppercase D dash mark. And exactly what does it do? Is it like a shield? Is it a, what is it?
Yeah, it confirms on the domain level, on the website domain level, that the person who is sending the email is who they say they are. It sets up rules for authenticating that, but it also prevents people from using the domain to send out malicious emails that are spoofing.
And do we know who, besides the Russians, would have an interest in getting these emails? Because I don't think that it would be just foreign interference, right?
No, but I mean, it could be used, you know, to gain intelligence on another campaign. You know, if you're a rival campaign, someone could want to spoof the emails to kind of get some intelligence. It could be used by cyber attackers who want to hijack the domains or hijack the email addresses and you know, kind of shake them down for money. There's all kinds of reasons for email spoofing and phishing. And also, you know, not all of them might necessarily be targeting the campaigns. It might just be, you know, random phishing attacks that just happen to get caught up in them.
Because we've heard how valuable data is these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So they really need to protect themselves because it is a lot of exposure out there.
Well, thank you, Omar. You can find Omar Gallaga at techminutetexas.com. And it's always good to see you.
Thanks, Joy. I appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas Congressman Al Green is calling on his colleagues to include concerns about President Trump's comments on race in articles of impeachment. The Houston Democrat says Trump needs to be impeached for his, quote, racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, transphobia, and xenophobia, end quote. Green also told C-SPAN today he's frustrated with the lack of diversity among the legal scholars who testified before the House Judiciary Committee Wednesday.
For too long, one party tends to ignore people of color, and the other party takes people of color for granted.
Earlier today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced Democrats will draft articles of impeachment against Trump. A voluntary evacuation order is in place for residents of Port Neches near Beaumont. Houston Public Media's Davis Land has more.
Officials found elevated levels of butadiene in the air. That's a chemical used in rubber manufacturing. That comes after fires at the TPC Group facility burned for nearly a week. High humidity overnight was said to keep vapors close to the ground. Emergency management officials say the levels they observed don't pose a serious health risk, but people could experience dizziness, headaches, and other symptoms. The voluntary evacuation is in place until further notice.
Davis Land reporting, funding for the agency that monitors and regulates pollution in Texas dropped by more than a third over the past decade, according to a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project. The nonprofit says 2018 spending for the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality was about $200 million less than it was in 2008. That's as the state's overall budget grew by 41%. EIP's director Eric Schaefer says Texas had the second largest decline in funding behind Wisconsin.
What's going on in a state where you've got big population growth, major expansion of petrochemical industry, and increasing number of accidents, and more inspections that need to happen, and declining environmental budgets?
Nationwide, 30 states cut spending for environmental agencies over that time. Tech giants say they're working with law enforcement to prevent mass shootings, such as the attacks in El Paso and Odessa. Staff from companies including Google and Microsoft testified before Texas lawmakers Wednesday. Facebook's Anna Martinez told state senators they reach out whenever they see a credible threat of harm.
We have a long history of working successfully with the Department of Justice, the FBI, state and local law enforcement, and other government agencies to address a wide variety of threats on our platform.
The head of the Texas Department of Public Safety says he believes tech companies do want to do the right thing, but there's room for improvement. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980. Reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. SierraNevada.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The Migrant Protection Protocols, also known as the Remain in Mexico policy, has so far forced more than 57,000 migrants to wait in Mexico while their immigration cases wind through immigration court. At a congressional hearing on the policy, Laura Pena, an attorney for the Texas Civil Rights Project, told lawmakers Remain in Mexico is a violation of U.S. law and puts the Central American asylum seekers in danger.
Asylum seekers are being returned to dangerous cities where organizations have documented hundreds of incidents of kidnappings and violence.
On the other hand, Congressman Mike Rogers, the Republican ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee, defended Remain in Mexico.
I wholeheartedly support the Remain in Mexico policy. I think it's an essential policy, and it is in no way inhumane. MPP discourages non-meritorious or false asylum claims and actually helps decrease the wait time for immigrant court hearings.
But a recent analysis by Human Rights First found 340 publicly reported instances of kidnapping, rape, torture, and other types of violence against migrants who were returned to Mexico under the policy. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies went to Nuevo Laredo to find out how is Remain in Mexico actually working.
I'm at a nondescript house in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico. To get inside, there is an iron gate to unlock and a curtain in front of a big wooden door. Once inside, I find this small house is crammed full with people. Central American refugees, mostly mothers and their children, many are sitting on the floor of a hallway.
We're renting the house for them to stay here.
Ruth Ortiz is my guide. She is the daughter of Pastor Lorenzo Ortiz, who is providing food, clothing, and shelter for the asylum seekers waiting in Mexico.
This has been open since August. So this place is needed, we will continue to help.
About 100 people are in this shelter. Every space is taken up. The little concrete back patio is filled with cots and clotheslines for an extra sleeping area. On this day, Pastor Ortiz was called to Monterey, where he runs another refugee house. But I spoke to him on the phone as he drives back to Nuevo Laredo.
I got six people coming with me from Monterey. They're coming to the hearings tomorrow. And then I got to go straight to the bridge and pick up the ones that are there already. There's about 80 people already waiting.
The immigration court hearings are held in a white circus tent next to the International Bridge in Laredo, Texas. The asylum seekers line up at 4 in the morning. They're allowed to cross for a video link hearing with an immigration judge, and then they're sent right back to Nuevo Laredo. This is the system that came about last June called Remain in Mexico. This has dramatically decreased the number of asylum seekers allowed into the U.S. but it puts the asylum seekers in danger. In Matamoros, a refugee camp was set up, but Nuevo Laredo is so dangerous that authorities wouldn't allow a camp.
In Nuevo Laredo, people are really in hiding rather than out in the open.
Sister Denise LaRocque has been bringing supplies from San Antonio for the refugees.
In Matamoros, they're out in the open, but they're very close to the port of entry, whereas here, they're really in hiding.
They're hiding from the cartels. According to a 2018 State Department report, there are no safe areas in border cities like Matamoros and Nuevo Laredo due to gunfights, grenade attacks, and kidnappings. The State Department has labeled this region a level 4 threat risk. That's the same category as Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. The cartels prey on the Central American refugees by kidnapping them and torturing them until their relatives pay a ransom.
So there was one time that the bad guys came.
Nos tiraron todos al piso, la gente corrió para acá atrás.
Santiago, the shelter's manager, said gunmen busted in and ordered everyone on the ground. They wanted to know who was running this operation, and when they learned it was a Christian group helping migrants and not a rival cartel, they left. But Santiago says everyone is afraid that the cartels will return. At the shelter, one woman from Guatemala who didn't want to give her name explained how she had been kidnapped in Mexico.
And they just got me into a vehicle and they just placed a jacket on my face.
For 8 days, along with other migrants, she was tied up with tape over her mouth. She managed to get free, climb out of a window, and find her way to this shelter. And she has a message for President Donald Trump. She says Mexico is a very dangerous place, and she hopes he hears about what's happening and it touches his heart.
The United States has created this crisis at the Mexican border.
Sister Denise LaRocque says it's the policies under Trump that created Remain in Mexico.
Putting families in the hands of corrupt officials, gang members, cartels.
And for these people, that means remain in danger. In Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, David Martin Davies reporting.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. I've always wanted to highlight the work of Scenic Texas. It's a nonprofit organization focused on preservation and beautification. One way it encourages cities to get involved is through the Scenic City Certification Program. It recognizes cities for their demonstrated commitment to high-quality scenic standards for public roadways and spaces. That's the kind of thing that was near and dear to Lady Bird Johnson's heart. Scenic Texas has 5 levels of certification, ranging from recognized to platinum. In 2019, 21 Texas cities were recognized or upgraded their status through the program, bringing the total number of certified cities across Texas to more than 80. Obviously, that's too many to highlight here. Right now, most of the cities that have pursued certification are clustered along the I-35 corridor and in the Houston area. They range from big cities such as Arlington to tiny Argyle, Texas. In the entry-level recognized category, Nacogdoches and Dayton are among those cities certified for preservation and beautification efforts. And at the bronze level, Beaumont was certified for its commitment to add landscaping to medians, while Marble Falls made the list for its innovative historic downtown wayfinding program. Getting silver recognition are cities including College Station and Grapevine, as well as McAllen, which was upgraded from recognized to silver in 2016 for efforts including its graffiti removal program and changes to its stormwater system to prevent flooding. The next level is gold, which Cuero was rewarded after strengthening its sign code. South Padre also earned this recognition for efforts to reduce development on beaches, burying all of its utility lines, and keeping billboards out of the city. And at the top rank, platinum, are cities including Southlake and Fairview. Fairview earned high points for historic preservation with a focus on the railroad route that once ran through town. And it also requires all town construction projects to include public art. If these types of projects are important to you, you could plan a whole trip using the Scenic City Certification website. And there's even a map to help you find cities near you. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
Marika Flatt is travel editor for Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can find more weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And it's time now for another edition of
Texan.
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 Translation.
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 Texan.
Translation.
Yes, it's our monthly look at Texas linguistics. We break down the speech of one well-known Texan with Lars Henricks. He's a professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin and director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. He talked with Texas Standard's host, David Brown, about this month's well-known Texan.
Well, this week we're doing things a little differently. Mm-hmm. Today we're going to talk about someone who isn't from Texas. They didn't even grow up speaking English, in fact.
Whoa.
But who spent a lot of time here as an adult.
Well, let's hear this first clip and see if we can identify this person.
I left Germany over 20 years ago and I became a Texan. So thank you guys for having me and we'll see you soon.
So wait a minute. When did you leave Germany, Lars? This sounds like a journey you're at least familiar with.
12 years ago, yes. Yeah.
This is another fairly well-known German who made the move, Dirk Nowitzki, late the Dallas Mavericks. So the NBA now in full swing, and even though Nowitzki retired at the end of the last season, I guess this would, what, be a good opportunity to check out how this Texan accent developed over that time, right?
Yeah, let's see how he sounded when he came here.
I'm facing now guys that I only saw on TV so far. So it's, for me, I didn't realize it so far. Again, my own apartment was a big thing. And, you know, we practiced twice a day during the practice camp, the training camp. But then I had to get all my stuff that was pretty stressed up.
So that was when he came here, as you were saying, back in 1998. And he was sounding a little bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger there, to me, to my ears anyway. Maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a native speaker of German. I hear the Austrian and Schwarzenegger. And,
okay, all right.
And Dirk, for me, that is a textbook German accent in low confidence in speaking English. He doesn't have the experience speaking it so much yet. And he's also still searching for the appropriate words. He has a false cognate, a false friend here. He says, this is so great. I didn't realize it so far.
Guys that I only saw on TV so far. So I didn't realize it so far.
What he means to say is, I can't even believe it yet.
I see what you're saying. So he's still making errors, as one would expect if they just arrived in the United States. So let's move on down the road about 20 years or so and contrast what we just heard with a much more recent clip. This one is from the end of the last NBA season after Nowitzki announced his retirement.
I want to clear my head. I want to travel. I want to enjoy my family that sacrificed so much over the last years and see my kids and then go from there.
Spoken like a lifelong American. To me.
So I would say the accent hasn't changed too much. I could still pick out a number of features of learners' English. And he says American things like, I wanna.
I wanna, right. But still, well, I don't hear anything specifically Texan. He nary said a y'all. You think that's ever going to change for someone of Nowitzki's age?
No, I think he's had his chance, but he's lived in Dallas, and Dallas is a metropolis. And if we had dropped him in Lufkin 20 years ago in East Texas, where there is a strong Texas accent, you would probably hear some of that in his speech now, even though he's a learner. But you are right, he's an adult learner, and especially the phonetics of language learning go a lot more slowly at our age than they do when you're 12. So chances are he would stick with most of what he's learned up to the age of arrival.
But I'm intrigued by what you just said about Lufkin. Are you suggesting that if Dirk Nowitzki was playing for the Lufkin Luddites or something, I don't know, that he might actually develop a sort of accent because of the fact that Lufkin is less perhaps cosmopolitan than the Metroplex?
That is, yeah, I would suggest that. As a language learner, you do follow the model of the environment that you're in. And in Dallas, you have a pretty low input of traditional Texas English, whereas in a small town in East Texas, you get a lot more of that and much more regularly.
Now, just out of curiosity, Professor, does listening to Nowitzki speak remind you at all of your own experience learning English as a German speaker?
Reminds me that the struggle is real and we have to sort out these features, and head is not the same as had, and hat is not the same as hat, and all those things.
Yeah.
I went down the same road for sure, linguistically, not with my basketball.
Alas. Well, it's fascinating stuff, as always, from Lars Henriks, professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin and the director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. We've been talking with him about the voice of adopted Texan Dirk Nowitzki. Professor Henriks, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thanks, David.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Stories of inhumane conditions inside immigrant detention centers, many operated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, dominated news this summer. You may remember the headlines. Overcrowded conditions, inadequate food and sanitation, children getting sick, and a lack of oversight in ICE facilities. ICE has been at the forefront of the Trump administration's border crackdown, and now it turns out the agency had help from a well-connected consulting firm. Ian McDougall is the ProPublica investigative reporter breaking this story in his article, How McKinsey Helped the Trump Administration Carry Out Its Immigration Policies. It was co-published with the New York Times. Ian, thank you so much for joining us at the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Can we start with this firm, with McKinsey, because it's not very well known, but people call it the father of management consulting. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's a massive global consulting, management consulting firm, really views itself and is viewed as the most prestigious of the bunch. And although they started doing sort of more traditional management consulting for corporations, they have since, especially in the last 10 years, expanded into a lot of public sector work for government agencies in the U.S. and across the globe.
What makes them so effective?
Well, you know, their reputation has been built up over almost 100 years in the corporate sector. They're viewed as having some of the brightest young minds, and they do recruit some of the brightest graduates from colleges and business schools. And I think that's a big source of their reputation.
And so the Obama administration brought them in. They had a contract to advise ICE under the Obama administration. Then it continued under the Trump administration. But the contract shifted a bit, or maybe the focus. How did it shift?
It did, yeah. So it began under the Obama administration as more of a kind of bureaucratic overhaul, improving processes and so on. But after President Trump signed these two executive orders in January 2017, attempting to initiate this immigration crackdown, the work shifted on the hiring front to helping ICE hire the 10,000 new immigration officers the president had hired, and on the procurement side to helping ICE try more efficiently and cheaply, really, to expand its detention capacity, anticipating a large influx of new detainees.
And that's in part where your investigation really focused. You looked at hundreds of recommendations that McKinsey made to ICE, ramping up hiring, lowering contracting costs. Please tell us which of these hundreds of recommendations were in fact implemented.
Well, the some of the hiring ideas were, although budget constraints have prevented ICE from hiring anywhere near the 10,000 new immigration officers noted in the executive order, they also seem to have, one of the suggestions from McKinsey was to move longer term detainees to less expensive facilities, which often means county jails and rural parts of the country where conditions are often not great. And ICE had been doing that before working with McKinsey, but it has increased that practice since, advocates say. McKinsey helped ICE renegotiate contracts at 5 detention facilities. Most of the facilities are run by contractors, not by ICE. And that involved negotiating for cuts to staff. Some of the more, what some folks at ICE felt were more troubling suggestions, like cutting costs for spending on food or things like that.
So yeah. Is that how they were saving?
That was one of the ways, cutting the per diem cost for food for detainees. And those cost analyses, ICE says, remain on the books. So even though they didn't make it into these 5 contracts, they are still available for future contract negotiations.
McKinsey no longer has a contract with ICE, but it has signed a new contract, and it has to do with work in the border. Tell us a little bit about that.
There were two. One was about helping CBP revise the Obama-era border strategy for the Trump era, which includes initiatives like building the border wall that President Trump has promised to build, and other initiatives. The other contract is really more of a bureaucratic HR sort of project, but it does include offices that support frontline border agents like IT and facilities management.
Ian McDougall is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, welcome back. He's social media editor with the Talk of Texas on social media.
Hi, Joy.
What do you hear?
Well, hearing from folks about a bunch of stuff we talked about on the show, including that story we just heard, how this consulting firm McKinsey. Is their role in helping Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, tackle the, stepped up enforcement at the border under the Trump administration has come to light. Tweet from a listener, Eclecticity. He tweets us that McKinsey's work here speaks to a huge disconnect between our country's stated ideals and a narrow, mean-spirited philosophy that will do nothing but make our country weaker and no longer the beacon of hope for the world. Always a very astute listener and tweeter there, Eclecticity. Remarkable story really just like took off in my feed when it broke on Twitter yesterday. So I was glad we got to.
Well, there's
hear more
only
about that.
A few ways in which you can save money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, by doing all the things that we just heard about there in the segment. So, remarkable story there. Another remarkable story continuing to play out, of course, the impeachment proceedings against the president.
It is a remarkable story. Yeah. I don't know if you know this, Wells, but I arrived in the United States during the Clinton impeachment.
Oh, okay.
And so... Yeah. I mean, for me, it's recent history. You know, it's been more than 2 decades ago.
I know it's strange to think about, how long ago that was, but yet how sort of recent. Like, we all have, obviously the particulars of the impeachment and the sexual aspect. And I just remember being, listening to those details in the car, like with my father, and being like, this is awkward.
Wow. yes. Didn't think about that.
So I think, it's that sort of event where everyone is the one of those flashbulb memories where everyone has a recollection.
Yeah, and our listeners are talking about impeachment.
And what we're going to hear here, see here, is still up for debate, but they're sounding it out. On Facebook, M. Paul Lewis, he's talking about the expert testimony we heard yesterday. Mm-hmm. He says, not one of the 4 legal scholars made the claim that there were no impeachable offenses. The lone dissenter just didn't think there was a strong enough case yet to proceed with an impeachment. Mm. And another, and that was...
That's interesting because it's that's what I heard from them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another interesting point that another listener picks up, that Mitchell Benbow. He writes that before yesterday, it was nothing but complaints about how this is taking too long. Now it's not long enough, and we need more fact witnesses. Yeah, echoing what we just heard, it was interesting that the expert called by the Republicans was really interested in, maybe slowing this process down. sort of echoing what we've heard from a lot of voices on the further left, that maybe we shouldn't have such a narrow, impeachment inquiry.
Well, the beautiful thing about social media is that the conversation continues there. Please find us on Facebook or on Twitter at Texas Standard. Thank you, Wells Dunbar, and on behalf of the entire Texas Standard team, I'm Joy Diaz.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1-4 in their communities. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.